Okay, thank you. Thanks for the invitation to speak here. Looks like it'll be a fun little conference. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about an anthropic explanation of the dark matter abundance. In particular, I'm going to analyze a very particular model, a very small piece of the landscape. But I think you'll see that what we learn here will generalize. But I want to focus on something rather specific. So here's the model that I'm going to analyze. So first of all, I'm interested in only predicting one quantity, which I'm going to call zeta, which is the ratio of the dark matter density to the baryon density today. Okay, that's the quantity I'm going to focus on. And this is the model that I'm going to consider. I'm going to consider a model, and there are other models that would have this same feature, but just to be concrete, I'm interested in a model with some sort of metastable false vacuum which eternally inflates, okay? So the role of this thing is just to eternally inflate. Then we have some ordinary slow roll inflation in here. We have our vacuum down here, and then we have some negative vacuum energy vacuum down here. So here's our vacuum. It has our value of lambda. It has our particle physics. Okay, everything that we know about is right here. In particular, what I'm going to assume about this vacuum for the moment is that I'm going to assume that there's an axion which solves the strong CP problem, and I'm going to assume that this axion has a decay constant which is around the gut scale. All right, this is a very natural assumption from the point of view of particle physics. All right, that's the model I'm going to consider here. Now, the question is, what is the prediction for the dark matter abundance in this model? And is it in conflict with observation or not? Okay, so I'll explain a little bit more, but the observed value is about 5. Okay, there's about 5 times as much dark matter as baryonic matter. And naively, in a model like this with a gut scale axion decay constant, naively you would predict that the dark matter ratio is something more like 10 to the 3. Something much larger than 5.
That means you assume that A over F is 1.
That's right, yeah. So I'll go through this in more detail, but... So ordinarily, you would say a model like this, you would expect to see far more dark matter than we do, because the axion acts like dark matter at late time, and for generic value of the misalignment angle, you're going to get much more dark matter. Okay, so that's the model I'm going to consider. It's a very simple model, and just to draw a picture, what's going to happen in this model is that the universe is eternally inflating here. From time to time, so outside here is eternal inflation. From time to time, bubbles form, and slow roll inflation happens inside these bubbles. Okay? And then up here, eventually, perhaps some observers form. And locally here, so let me assume for simplicity here that the Hubble constant in the false vacuum up here, and also the Hubble constant during inflation, are both much less than the axion decay constant. And this is not really going to be crucial, but let me just assume that. Then the axion is basically some massless field, both in the false vacuum and during inflation, until late times when the potential becomes important. Okay, the effective potential for the axion, once the temperature gets low enough, is given by integrating out QCD instantons, and it looks like that. All right, but that's not at all important until the temperature drops below the QCD scale. All right, so what happens is that this axion is just a massless field in this false vacuum, so it just does some random walk. Any value of theta is as good as any other value. Theta is pretty uniform on horizon scales. So what happens is that locally in here, we start off each one of these bubbles with some particular value of the misalignment angle. Okay, so here's theta 1, here's theta 2, and you make an infinite number of bubbles, so you have some statistical distribution for the axion misalignment angle. Okay? And different values of the misalignment angle lead to different values of the dark matter ratio. Okay? So, and that's in this model, that's the only parameter, really, which is controlled statistically. I mean, of course, things like the CMB are as well. But so what we have here is some sort of statistical ensemble where you would naturally make a probabilistic prediction for the dark matter ratio. Now, the surprise is that quantitatively, and I should also say, there's clearly an issue of regulating infinities here. Okay? The surprise is that when you regulate infinities, all right, of course the infinities are that there are an infinite number of people, an infinite number of observers seeing different values of the dark matter ratio. The surprise is that when you regulate the infinities carefully, using either Raphael's causal diamond prescription or the scale factor proposal of Vilenkin and collaborators, what you find is that, in fact, the statistical prediction here is in good agreement with observation. And to give you some quantitative measure of that, once I do the statistics here, what I find is that 30% of observers see a dark matter ratio less than our value, while 70% see a dark matter ratio bigger than our value. So the value, the ratio of 5, which we see, is quite typical. It's within the central 50% of the probability distribution, and you really can't complain about this model on those grounds. Okay? So that's going to be the bottom line. Along the way, you're also going to see that this what goes into this result will apply to other models of dark matter, which are not just the Scud scale axion.
I don't understand that. So when you write the squiggle, that's theta, right? So you're looking at theta?
All right, sorry. This is zeta, which
theta,
I define.
Theta, yeah.
Sorry?
Yeah. Theta, the misalignment angle. So you're saying...
Oh, I'm sorry.
So
yeah, okay. There's, yeah, sorry. Yes. All right, this is a theta. Sorry. Yes.
And you're fixing a value, so F axion is fixed. It's the same in all values.
F axion is fixed, that's right.
So 30% of the observers in this ensemble see a theta smaller than some small number?
Some number like 10 to the minus 3, that's right.
So
it's surprising.
So
I agree, and I will explain.
Which infinities are you regulating again?
Well, so in this context, you keep on forming bubbles with different misalignment angles, okay? And so everyone happens an infinite number of times, and within each bubble you have an infinite open FRW universe. So those are the infinities that I'm regulating. Yeah?
Question. This axion is literally the QCD axion.
It is the QCD axion. Oh, this is...
much smaller.
No, that's right. Okay, yeah, so let me go through this in more detail. Yeah. Now, of course, the value of theta is quite small today.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, any other questions about what I'm claiming here and what the model is? Okay. So, just one minimum, yeah. That's right.
Is there some, you could explain the physics that determines theta?
it's just going to be random. Sorry, maybe I should be more clear here. So here's the potential. The potential is a function of phi, okay? And I'm assuming that the axion is just, massless. I'm assuming that that's the entire potential, okay? So V is equal to, the total potential is equal to this function of phi plus, the function of, plus the axion potential. And the axion potential, when it matters, is given by this thing. So up here in the false vacuum is just a massless field, which can take any value as well as any other value. Okay, it's just some compact massless field, which sits. It basically has no potential up here. That's a different assumption you could make, which I think would lead to the same conclusions, but it's not as obvious. So you could assume. So basically, I was assuming that the false vacuum Hubble is less than the. Right. You can also assume that the axion doesn't exist up there, and then you'd probably end up with the same conclusion. But to be concrete, let me assume this: that the axion exists up there, and also in our vacuum, and it's just massless until these QCD effects become involved. That's right. So there are a lot of other assumptions which would lead to this same conclusion that there's that the axion takes a randomly selected value. But let me just use this one to be concrete. I think you could embed potentials where it would like to tunnel to a particular value of theta.
Right.
There's no reason that would be close to zero. But you could invent that. You could analyze that situation.
Right.
Also. I just really did that for simplicity. I mean, there could be others. The point is, I want to focus in on a particular quantity. What I enjoy about this example is that you're sort of forced, is that it's very natural to make a statistical prediction, even though there's really only one vacuum we could live in. But, of course, you could consider others, and things would just get somewhat more complicated.
And probably doesn't get important
that the tunneling is just my favorite way of making infinities and thinking about eternal inflation. No, you're right. So I wanted to make concrete assumptions, but this would apply much more generally. But let me stick to a context where it definitely applies, and then we can talk about the generalizations. Okay, so that's the model. All right, so let me review the axion and the dark matter abundance briefly. Okay, so the axion is a solution to the strong CP problem. What is the strong CP problem? The strong CP problem is that you could add something to the QCD action, which would be some angle times the integral of f wedge f. This would cause CP violation in the strong interactions, okay? Observationally, we know that CP is not violated in the strong interactions, so a very good approximation. So experimentally, we know that this is less than something like 10 to the minus 10, okay? But it's not obvious why it should be so small. There's certainly not a direct anthropic explanation for why this should be less than 10 to the minus 10. So a popular solution to this problem is to add a dynamical field, the axion. So we add something else to the action, which is a dynamical theta term. And then we also add some kinetic term for that field. Okay, and because it's a dimensionless field, if you count the dimensions, you need something with mass dimension here. And that thing is called the axion decay constant. What it is model dependent, Okay, so you have one free parameter in this theory. Okay, in many nice simple models of particle physics, this is at the gut scale, which is like 10 to the 16 GeV or so. And in many string theory models, the axion is often between, in simple models that we know how to understand, it's between 10 to the 15 GeV and 10 to the 19 GeV. Okay? These are just the things which are easiest to get. When Witten and Svercek looked at a whole variety of models, these were the things that they knew how to get. So,
because the paper is weird, they say that in the abstract. But in the text, I have the whole section saying that if you have warping, that it's very easy to get much smaller. And warping, one can argue, is rather generic.
Well, okay. Certainly, I think it's possible to get other values. Maybe I have a quote from them. I'm really just shamelessly using authority figures to argue that this is a natural range to consider. Okay, certainly from the particle physics point of view, if you're building a gut, this is a nice value for the axion to take. So it's worth considering. But I certainly don't want to try to claim that there's a theorem. You could certainly imagine constructions where F axion is smaller. All right, this is just a natural range that you might end up with. Yeah?
One other question. I thought there are bounds on the axion decay constant just from astrophysics and from the Voronoi experiment, where there's only a tiny range.
Well, so the upper part of that bound is from the dark matter abundance, which is what I'm talking about.
But also okay. Physical bounds are much smaller at phase where axions interact.
That's right. So this is a very, maybe this is a good time to mention this. So this is a very, before we go too far. So why does this solve the strong CP problem? So first of all, this term clearly can be just absorbed by a field redefinition here. And then if you compute the effective potential for the axion, you find that the effective potential is this, which is minimized at zero. So dynamically, this is a dynamical mechanism which turns off strong CP violation. Okay, so that's why it solves the strong CP problem. All right, now to return to axions like this, these have large decay constants. The mass of the axion, so if you look here, the canonically normalized field is F axion times theta. And so if you compute the mass of the axion expanding around the minimum of this potential, what you find is that it's given by the QCD scale squared divided by F axion. So these axions that we're talking about here, in this case, have something like masses of 10 to the minus 9 EV or so. They're extremely light, extremely weakly interacting, and really the only way to see them is by their cosmological signatures. Okay.
Is that true? I thought there were some proposals for resonance cavity experiments that could...
I don't know if it's the situation is totally settled, but I think that one thing that's certainly true is that the larger FA is, the harder those things are to do. Whether it's completely out of the question to see the gut scale axions with those types of experiments, I'm not sure. But it seems. I mean, is it ruled out that you could directly observe these gut scale axions? I mean, do you have a pretty good?
I think in the lab there is no problem.
I mean, like Witten refers to some paper that Scott Thomas was supposedly writing, which was never published. So, okay, I think the evidence that you can do it is not good. But let's hold out hope. All right. So, okay.
Now, there's only, this is perfectly fine. It's a great model from particle physics point of view, or from string theory. There's only one problem, which is that the axion acts like dark matter. At late time, and so we have to compute how much dark matter we end up Now, because this theta is a dynamical field, it's going to turn out that the amount of dark matter depends on the initial conditions for this field. And as I described earlier, in this model, we have some initial conditions, which is that this axion takes some initial value, which is roughly homogeneous in the horizon size, which is called the axion initial misalignment angle. And it's clear in this model that that's just some random variable, which can be anywhere from 0 to 2 pi. It's uniformly distributed from 0 to 2 pi. All right, so that's the initial conditions. Now, given some local value of this misalignment angle, how do things evolve? So if we write down the equation of motion for this thing, we have some kind of standard cosmological equation with some Hubble friction, and then eventually some mass term. So the equation of motion looks something like that. Now, as long as the Hubble constant is bigger, is much larger than the mass of the axion, then it's dominated by friction, and the axion is basically stuck at the initial misalignment angle. Okay? And so during that period of time, now you start to see why this is dangerous. During this period of time, so it's just some homogeneous field which is just sitting there, and so the energy density in that field just redshifts like vacuum energy. In other words, it doesn't redshift. Meanwhile, ordinary stuff is redshifting, like radiation. And that's why this thing, even though they're very light, they're in danger of dominating the energy density at late times. Okay, so when does this thing start? When does it start oscillating, and how does it behave after that? Okay, so the mass of the axion, so when is the Hubble constant equal to the mass of the axion? So the axion mass is lambda QCD squared over F axion. Okay, and when is that equal to Hubble? Well, the Hubble constant squared during radiation domination is temperature to the fourth divided by M Planck squared. Okay, so if we're setting Hubble equal to this mass, we have temperature squared over M Planck. Now, so we're considering high-scale axions here, and so this temperature ends up being pretty close to the Planck scale, pretty close to the QCD scale, sorry. There's some factor here which goes like M Planck over F axion. All right, so this doesn't necessarily make a lot of sense. It's telling you that it starts to oscillate a little bit above the QCD scale, but you shouldn't necessarily believe this formula for the potential above the QCD scale. And I can tell you more precise formulas for really how this works, but roughly what happens for these high-scale axions is that they start oscillating around the time the temperature is equal to the QCD scale, up to small corrections. Okay? All right, so then what happens after they start oscillating? Well, now you're solving this equation, but now the mass term is more important. And I'm not going to solve that equation for you, but what you can show is that the energy density in the axion redshifts like matter once it begins oscillating. Okay, so after the time when it begins oscillating. Now, it's a bit funny. It's not like some ordinary kind of matter, which is nice and heavy. Instead, it's some coherent field, some homogeneous coherent field with a very small mass. But nevertheless, it does redshift like matter. Okay, so now we can compute the ratio of the dark matter to the baryonic matter. So let's compute it around the time. Let's compute that ratio at the time when the axion begins oscillating. Okay, because the ratio, since they both will redshift like matter after that. So let's compute the energy density in axions at the time when the temperature is around lambda QCD. Okay, so we can use this potential here. And you're going to see that we're going to be interested in a regime where the misalignment angle is rather small, so I can approximate this sine as just a quadratic function. And so what this looks like is lambda QCD to the fourth times theta initial squared. Okay? Now we can compute the baryon density at this time. And a convenient way to do that is to say that this is the mass of the baryon, the mass of the proton, which is 1 GeV, times the number density of baryons. But let's write this as the number density of photons times the number density of baryons times the baryon to photon ratio. Okay, the baryon to photon ratio isn't affected at all by this initial misalignment angle. Okay, so this is some number like 10 to the minus 9, whereas this number we have is GeV here. This number, the photon density, we're at a temperature around the QCD scale, so what we have here is lambda QCD cubed. All right, and then we have a number like 10 to the minus 9. Okay, so if you compute this ratio of these two numbers, what you find is that the ratio of dark matter to ordinary matter is, of course, proportional to theta squared. Okay, and then times some number, which is a rather large number. And if you want to actually, so at this stage, of course, this derivation hasn't been very precise, but if you want to know what this actual number looks like, so this ratio compared to the value it takes in our universe, okay, it looks like this. Well, let me just tell you for f(axion) near the gut scale, it looks like something like 10 to the fifth times the initial misalignment angle squared. Okay, and I can tell you a formula for other f axions, but that's not really the crucial point here. The point is just that compared to the value we see, this dark matter abundance is some large number, 10 to the 5, times this initial misalignment angle squared. Okay, so you're going to need some rather small misalignment angle to reproduce what we see, which you probably already knew. Okay, so there's clearly a danger. All right, so this is the value for f axion near the gut scale. All right, and so there's clearly a danger here, which is too much dark matter. Okay, so now, good, but I claimed that the amount of dark matter is going to be in good agreement with observation. So what is the trick going to be here? Well, so remember that each one of these bubbles with their own misalignment angle is an infinite open FRW universe. So how am I going to get a finite? So naively, the number of observations of different dark matter ratios, it's infinity, no matter what number you ask about. How am I going to regulate those infinities? I'm going to regulate the infinities by using the causal diamond proposal of Raphael and I'll come back to talk about the other way of regulating affinities. So what I'm going to do is I'm only going to count observations within one observer's backward light cone. So within the one horizon volume. Okay, and now to see that something interesting is going to happen here, let's just do a warm-up calculation. Let's compute the number of baryons inside one horizon volume at the time when lambda starts to dominate, which is more or less today. All right, let's just calculate that, and then I can give you a more general calculation. But let's just compute the number of baryons inside the horizon at the time when lambda starts to dominate. Now remember, I'm not doing anything to the baryon-photon ratio. I'm not doing anything to baryogenesis here. All I'm doing is dialing the amount of dark matter by dialing this axion misalignment angle. Okay? All right. So at the time when lambda starts to dominate, by definition, rho matter is equal to rho lambda. Okay? That's by definition. Now, rho baryon is equal to rho matter divided by 1 plus the dark matter ratio. Okay? The horizon size at the time t lambda is just set by the cosmological constant. So you can see that, first of all, the density of and by definition, rho matter equals rho lambda. So rho baryon at this time is rho lambda, which is some number which is just fixed by our cosmological constant, which is not varying in this model, divided by 1 plus the dark matter ratio.
Sorry, I don't understand rho baryon equals rho matter over 1 plus zeta. What's rho? Maybe I don't understand what your rho matter is.
Yeah, sorry. So this is supposed to be all matter here. So what I'm trying to compute is the number of baryons inside the horizon. So let me define rho matter to be all matter. Okay? By definition, at the time when lambda dominates, rho matter is equal to rho lambda. Okay?
I'm sure this is trivial, but I'm just having trouble keeping track of what you're keeping fixed then. So rho baryon is less because there's more dark matter.
At the moment I'm being annoying and just proving it mathematically, and I'm about to tell you why this happens. But let me just give you the mathematical proof first, such as it is. So let me just convince you by a chain of correct equations that it depends on the dark matter ratio. Okay? So here's the chain of equations. Let's consider the time t lambda. Okay, at that time, by definition, rho matter is equal to rho lambda. Rho baryon is a fraction of rho matter. So it's some fraction of rho lambda, which depends on this dark matter ratio. On the other hand, the horizon size is only set by the cosmological constant. And so that means the number of baryons at the time t equals t lambda is proportional to things which don't vary in this model times 1 over 1 plus the dark matter ratio. Now, why is this happening? Okay, what did I do with all those baryons since I wasn't changing baryogenesis? Well, what happened is that the universe expanded faster early on while it was matter-dominated. So, for example, if we go to some fixed temperature and we write the FRW equation, so here's the Hubble constant. So what we have here is rho matter, of course, so let's write it as rho baryon. Plus rho dark matter, plus rho radiation. Now let's analyze this at some fixed temperature. Okay, so at some fixed temperature, this radiation contribution goes like temperature to the fourth. This baryon contribution, because we haven't changed baryogenesis, goes like some baryon to photon ratio. Well. Right. So this baryon contribution is some fixed at a given temperature is fixed by this thing. And then we have rho dark matter. So you can see that holding this fixed, so this is independent at some fixed temperature. Rho baryon is independent of the amount of dark matter. The temperature is independent of the amount of dark matter. But the amount of dark matter, of course, is not. And what that means is that when you increase the amount of dark matter, you increase the Hubble constant. And so everything expands faster. And so what happens is just that some of the baryons just get expelled from the horizon just by the Hubble expansion before the time t lambda. Okay, it's a kind of a stupid geometrical effect, but it's quantitatively quite important if you believe that the right way to regulate infinities is to just restrict to one horizon volume.
So for somebody who doesn't spend their time thinking about the causal diamond of these things, you're perfectly allowed to take it as an input, but can you sort of give it some justification in this context? Can you, for example, why are you counting baryons at this fixed time t lambda, which is...
Oh, no, yeah, fair enough. Sorry. So let me be clear about what I'm supposed to do and what... So this was a warm-up computation here. So the correct thing to calculate here, and I should have said this earlier, by definition, the probability of measuring one value of the dark matter ratio divided by the probability of measuring another value is equal to the number of observations of this value compared to the number of observations of the other value. What do I mean by the number of observations? I mean restrict to, well, so there I need some way of regulating infinities. And so what I do is I count the number of observations within one horizon volume to compute the relative probabilities of measuring one value versus another. Okay? So, I mean, I think this is kind of an axiom, if you want. By assumption, in this model, the natural thing to do to compute the relative probability of measuring these two things is to just simulate the thing and count the number of observations of each value. Okay?
The number of observations is the number of variance.
Well, yeah, so I'll get to that. So in principle, the thing to do is to count the number of observations. That's infinite. So at the moment, I'm using Raphael's proposal, and I'm just counting the number of observations within one horizon volume. Okay? Now, what I want to do, now, the number of observations.
So you said that if the universe expands faster, some baryons are expelled from the horizon.
Yeah.
But
hold on, let me just finish this, because I should have said this before. Okay? So what I'm counting is the number of observations. Okay, what does that have to do with the number of baryons? Okay, so I can certainly write the number of observations as some integral over time, and then I can write the number of baryons as a function of time, and then I can write the number of observations per baryon per time. Okay, this is a mathematically correct thing to be able to do. Okay? Now, the key point is that this is a simple quantity to compute, so I want to compute it. This other quantity, the number of observations per baryon per time as a function of dark matter ratio, is a little bit more complicated. But what's been argued, yeah, so let me talk about that quantity there for a second. So what's been argued by a variety of authors is that this quantity is roughly independent of the dark matter ratio in a wide range of lambda, in a wide range of zeta, the dark matter ratio. Okay, sorry, what was your question?
Yeah, so you said that if the universe expands faster, you're going to expand more matter from the horizon.
Yes.
Perhaps let me see something, but before lambda long age, you're not expanding anything from the horizon. In fact, you are getting things coming inside the horizon. So if you want to, the horizon is
the event horizon, which you can only
in a lambda dominated.
No, any time I draw a past light cone from the future boundary of any space time, I just can only cross out of that horizon and come in. I mean, it's just a statement about.
Let's see, it's, but that's
just
the
like
the
something
called
into a black hole. It has nothing to do with whether it's inner space, right? It's just, I
see today as the universe. If there's no lambda today as the universe expands, I see points. I see more and more. Right.
Look. The issue is
not the surface that we're talking about.
The issue is different definitions of the horizon here, but I don't think we actually even need to talk about that. I mean, the point is just that the density of baryons, clearly the density of baryons today cares about what the Hubble rate was in the past, okay? And I've shown that the density of baryons depends on this thing, okay? So let's just, I mean, and that's going to be crucial in a different way of regulating infinities. This is going to be the relevant quantity anyway. Okay, but I think you can believe that if the density of baryons is smaller, then clearly there are going to be fewer inside the horizon at a time when lambda dominates.
Yeah,
right. Right. So the situation is this. I'm interested in counting the number of observations as a function of the dark matter ratio. I'm regulating it by only counting things in one horizon volume. All right. Now, I've divided into a simple quantity here and a quantity which takes some more computation. Fortunately, this quantity which takes more computation is the quantity which people have been banging their heads against, trying to make this sort of argument work without having this nice, simple geometrical thing to help them out. Okay? So let me give those people credit. So there's a paper by Tegmark, Aguirre, Rees, and Wilczek, where they argue that this quantity or in any case the number of observations per baryon, is more or less independent of the dark matter ratio in this range. All right. Roughly in this range, they argue that observer formation is unaffected. So the number of observers per baryon is roughly constant in this range. Okay. What happens is that if there's too little dark matter, then you start to have problems forming structure because the dark matter starts to form structure before ordinary matter does. And on the other hand, it's a little bit unclear what goes on here. They have some rather complicated argument about what could go wrong. This was also examined by Simeon Hellerman along with Volker, and their conclusion was that the maximum value might be as large as 10 to the 5. Okay? So it's either... So everyone seems to agree, although this is certainly a complicated question, but so far... People have concluded that observer formation is relatively unaffected by the dark matter ratio, all the way up to a dark matter ratio of 100.
What's an observer? A star? A galaxy?
These people were putting in pretty much any sort of anthropic consideration that they could get away with. So I think in this model, an observer means us.
Wilczek, I mean, how specific?
In this model, let's say that an observer, I think... In this model, let's say that an observer means us. Okay, I'm interested in what we're going to observe. The dark matter ratio, so I'm willing to put in
stars like
every piece of information that we have available to us. But you could just put in, you know, collapsed baryons or whatever you want to put in. I think even to get a number like 10 to the 5, you want to put in something more than just collapse. You want to put in star formation or something like that. Okay, so that's the situation with this quantity. And on the other hand, okay, so there's this integral over time. But let me roughly just compute this at times around now. So the number of observations, let me focus on observations which are happening around now. So the number of observations is the number of baryons times the number of observations per baryon
All right, this is the thing which is basically constant in that range. And then the number of baryons goes like 1 over 1 plus the dark matter ratio. Okay? So it's this weird geometrical fact that on very long scales, the dark matter ratio causes baryons to be more dilute, which allows us to have a chance of agreeing with observation here. Okay, because clearly this is weighting the, this is penalizing observations of a large dark matter ratio because there's just not as many of those. Okay, is that clear?
So what these people were doing in the old days is they were computing the number of observers per baryon.
That's right.
And in that case, you don't care if the baryons are diluted or not. So
that's right.
If you're at the upper end of the range somewhere, or at least in a physical place, which is much larger than.
Right.
So it's purely a question of which measure you use.
Yeah, that's right. So people were trying to make this anthropic argument work just counting the number of observers per baryon. And there you can see it's quite uncomfortable. So let's be more quantitative about this. So let's see. I was going to do a more... All right. There's a more a slightly more difficult argument, which I don't think we really need to go into, which would show you that the number of baryons as a function of time all through matter domination has this same dependence. I mean, I had planned to give you the argument. If somebody is curious, I
can just ask. I mean, maybe not the whole argument, but maybe I can just ask. My impression of this so far is that it's crucial that you're evaluating this thing at the time when the cosmological constant starts to dominate. The fact that the baryon relies crucially on the fact that in our universe,
All right, perfect. I was hoping I would have an excuse. I love this argument. Okay.
You're saying it doesn't
rely on that. Let me tell you the argument. Okay. I was hoping someone would give me an excuse. All right, but I'm going to use T lambda here just as a crutch, okay?
But I thought that was somehow the statement of what the measure was, what the causal, somewhere the causal.
It is important that I'm counting the number of observations within one causal patch.
But that's not equivalent to the statement that you're counting the number of observers at that special time?
No.
It's not.
That's right.
And even less than I thought.
If
the sum between lambda 0 today and we explain the observations by some other modification of gravity, what happens to this argument?
If lambda is exactly 0, then I think we would have to rethink this, because then the horizon size is not going to be finite, and then this causal diamond measure is not a successful way of regulating infinities. Okay? But actually, So let me. It's going to be important for the moment that these things are finite. Okay. So here's the argument. So let's start at T lambda, but I'm going to work backwards from there into a regime where things are not dominated by the cosmological constant. So I'm going to write the FRW equation here. So we have rho matter, which is still is all matter. We have rho lambda, and then we have rho radiation. Okay, let me assume a flat universe here. Now, what happens certainly in our universe is that the amount of radiation is negligible by the time that T lambda dominates. By the time that lambda dominates. Okay? Since that thing is negligible, then that means... Right. And also, as I've showed over here, rho matter at the time T lambda is by definition equal to rho lambda. So it's independent of the dark matter ratio. Okay? So everything on the right side is independent of the dark matter ratio at the time T lambda. And so what that means, now we can start evolving from there. So the scale factor as a function of time from lambda domination And the total matter density as a function of time from lambda domination are both independent of the dark matter ratio. What's going on here is there's sort of an attractor late-time solution once the radiation goes away, which has a particular scale factor as a function of time, a particular matter density as a function of time, with everything just redshifting away, and then ultimately lambda takes over. So this is a true statement as long as the energy density in photons is negligible. That's right. So you can start evolving away in either direction from T lambda, and you're going to have this attractor solution where the total matter density is independent of lambda. The total matter density is independent of zeta, the dark matter ratio, and the scale factor evolution. Everything is independent of the dark matter ratio, except that, of course, during this time, rho baryon, as a function of T minus T lambda, will have this dilution factor of 1 over 1 plus theta. Okay?
Can I try asking my question again? So, is it the case that, if I try to boil this down, can I try to say that, okay, so this range here that these other people found for this number mm-hmm. for baryon is sort of, if you just looked at that, you'd be somehow assuming that you're holding the number of this is the only quantity that you're varying anthropically. Everything else is being held fixed.
Right.
What this causal diamond thing is telling you that no, what you're supposed to be counting is the number of baryons. You're supposed to weight the possible observers by the number of baryons that you have in that universe at this time when the cosmological constant starts dominating.
I think your logic is not right. Well, the logic of the causal diamond measure is that you should just count the number of observations within one causal diamond. Okay? And now what everyone was always computing was the number of observations per baryon. That's what they were concerned about them being that's what they were concerned with here.
Right.
And in the causal diamond measure, the relevant quantity is maybe that's what you were saying.
Yeah, I wasn't dividing by n baryon in their thing.
Yeah, that's right.
They were doing the per baryon. Right, I got it.
Could you finish the sentence? Because yes. You didn't quite finish.
Yeah, so the right thing to do is count the total number of observations in the causal diamond, which is the thing that they were computing, which is more or less independent of the dark matter ratio, times the number of baryons in the causal diamond, which does depend on the dark matter ratio.
So their prior sort of I'm a baryon, your prior something more global.
Well,
so
they just weren't thinking about how you would regulate the spatial infinity.
Yeah. Okay. Got it.
But Ben, I think that, I mean, this game is very important to state very clearly what it is that you're holding fixed. So right, because nobody's pretending to like explain all quantities simultaneously. But
no, that's right.
One thing you could be holding fixed if you wanted to is both lambda and the time that it takes observers from the time that the galaxy formed. So you could also, and in which case you can only explain the dark matter,
right?
Or you could choose to fix only the time that it takes for observers to form when the galaxy formed, in which case you can explain both the cosmological constant and the dark matter.
Right. So here, this is a modest talk, and all I'm varying is I'm not changing anything except for the dark matter abundance. Which roughly means that the amount of time to evolve observers.
But here he only has one vacuum, right?
There's only one vacuum.
So he's not explaining the cosmological constant.
The question came up earlier: what would happen if the cosmological constant was much smaller, let's say? And
to me, that was the clearest thing in this talk. What are you varying? All right.
So
the other part is not because of the talk; it's because of me. But I think I'm still again.
So let me try to summarize the situation then here. So I think through the questions and stuff we've clarified what the situation is here. So this is roughly independent of dark matter ratio in some range. Okay. So and just to clarify this point about where these baryons are going, we can divide this into quantities which are independent of the dark matter ratio. and quantities which depend on the dark matter ratio. Okay? Now, because I'm not doing anything to baryogenesis, what's independent of the dark matter ratio is, for example, the baryon density at a fixed temperature, say at the temperature of decoupling, but really at any fixed temperature. That's independent of the dark matter ratio. And all of these other things here that I pointed out are also independent of the dark matter ratio. Okay? So rho matter as a function of time from lambda domination, as long as radiation is negligible. On the other hand, the time of matter radiation equality, the temperature at equality, those of course will change when I add more dark matter. And let's see if I wanted to put anything else in this chart.
I'm confused by just your first statement. I mean, rho baryon just above that table, you say it's just simply 1 over 1 plus zeta.
Right. So this is at some fixed time from lambda domination. It depends. Rho baryon at a fixed temperature, on the other hand, does not depend on the... Well, what happened is that the matching between temperature and time is affected by the dark matter abundance. So rho baryon at a fixed temperature is unchanged from what it was before, but rho baryon as a function of time is affected. Okay, and maybe a clearer way to say it would be that the temperature of the CMB is going to be a lot colder when you add this dark matter, because the photons get diluted more before today, because T equality is earlier when you add dark matter. The temperature at equality is higher. And so what we've done is just kind of diluted the baryons and also the photons by adding this dark matter. Okay.
So it is important that you assume that you observe it at a fixed time and not at a fixed temperature. I mean, that's why...
That's correct.
Yeah.
But given that I fixed the particle physics and everything, I think that's a very natural assumption.
Sure.
But that's right. No, it's absolutely important that the observers live. The observers are like us who take a long time to evolve.
Not the lambda. I mean,
that's right.
There are all these questions about what the lambda is.
That's correct. Yes. Thank you. Okay. So, good. So then let's just talk about how this works quantitatively then. Okay? Now, remember that we're getting this dark matter abundance from an axion. Okay? And the dark matter abundance was proportional to this initial misalignment angle squared. Okay? So that means that the prior distribution is flat in the square root of the dark matter abundance. So this is the prior probability distribution. Okay? On the other hand, the number of observations goes like this, my favorite dilution factor here, but in some range between up to some maximum value. Depending on, and so this is a cartoon, obviously, but it goes to zero outside that range. All right. And clearly, there should actually be some smooth function, but this cartoon will certainly be good enough for us. Okay. So if we plot, so let me plot things as a function of the square root of the dark matter ratio, since that's what the prior is flat in. So here's the square root of 100. So let's just keep in mind that the maximum value allowed by Tegmark, Aguirre, Reese, and Wolchek is 100. Okay. Now, here's the lower cutoff, square root of 2.5, and here's the observed value, square root of 5. And you can see that this, as a function of, is some quadratic thing as a function of the square root of lambda, and so it looks something like that. And now, and because I'm using this cartoon, it has these hard cutoffs at the edges. Now, the relevant question here is how many observations are on one side of us compared to the other side. That's the right way to measure the typicality of our observation. And what you find here is that 30% are here and 70% are there. Okay, so our observation of a dark matter ratio of 5 is quite typical in this model. Now, what's going to happen if we let this maximum value go to 10 to the 5, as Simeon was advocating? In that case, this thing is going to need to go all the way out here. But this is an integrable function here. Okay, the prior is flat in the square root of lambda, in the square root of zeta, and this thing has a zeta squared in the denominator, so it's integrable. So you can let it go to infinity, and the only effect is that that's going to change this 30% to a 25%, and it's going to change this to a 75%, and it still works quite well. So really the question of to what extent structure formation and observer formation is disrupted at very large values of the dark matter ratio is just not relevant here until you want to get within 5%. Now, on the other hand, if you didn't have this dark matter, if you didn't have this dilution factor here, then you would just have a flat line in the allowed region. And then the typicality of our measurement, then this probability here would be, first of all, quite small, and second of all, very sensitive to where this upper cutoff is. Okay? So the conclusion is that the prediction is in good agreement with observation.
What is the prediction, sir?
Well, so there's a statistical prediction for the dark matter ratio in this model. And this is the probability distribution for what you might measure. And so the thing to do is to take our measured value and ask how typical that is. If we hadn't measured it yet, then we would use this to, you know, to make a prediction for what we would measure. But since we've already measured it, we might as well just put that here and ask how typical it is. And the answer is it's quite typical. It's in the central 50% of the probability distribution. So I'm sorry it's not a sharper prediction for the dark matter ratio. And clearly, if you have a different theory where there's a very sharp prediction for the dark matter ratio, that might be more attractive. But this theory cannot be ruled out just based on its prediction for the dark matter ratio. Okay. And let me mention...
You're saying this is resting the fine-tuning.
Exactly. That's right.
So really, the only assumptions are that n observer over n baryon is some reasonable number. And
that's right.
It's fixed, yeah. You know, just some calculable number in some reasonable range.
But you could phrase it in terms of sigma, right? You could have started at the median here, and then we would be well within one sigma. And you could have started at the median in this whole, you know, calculation with observers per baryon, and we would be, I don't know, 5 sigma or whatever it would be. But
that's right. Yeah, you could phrase it in terms of sigmas or... Well, yeah. So this used the causal patch measure. Okay. Now, let me just very briefly. So the other measure, which is alive and well today, is the scale factor measure. And we showed that in the homogeneous approximation, the scale factor measure is equivalent to just following some fixed physical volume, and counting everything within that fixed physical volume. Okay, and so then what you find is that the number of observations in the scale factor measure is the number of baryons within some fixed physical volume times the number of observations per baryon. Okay, but the number of baryons within some fixed physical volume is proportional to the density of baryons, which is proportional to exactly the same dilution factor. So it comes out exactly the same. If you would consider situations where more things would vary, these two measures would differ. But in this simple model, they actually give precisely the same prediction.
So is there a simple way to say what the measure would be? I mean, the logic
say it could be anywhere from 2 to 10 to 5 or 100 or whatever.
Yeah.
And therefore, it's very unlikely to be 5. Is there a measure that makes that the correct statement? I mean, what's
well, you could try to just count the number of observers per baryon. The problem with that is that it's generically not finite because you have stupid things like Boltzmann brains and so on. So I haven't thought very hard about whether there is a natural proposal which would correspond to that. But
it's ironic, right, that, I mean, both these analyses and also the old analysis of Weinberg was basically done with a framework in mind of computing the numbers. For some reason, what we're supposed to do is compute the numbers of sort of variant. As far as we know today, there is no consistent measure that's not violently ruled out as a prediction that actually gives you this. So there's actually currently no basis for the alternative calculation as far as I the other thing that's amusing is that also the case of cosmological constant, this is with the axion, things improve a lot when you use, let's say, the positive patch measure, because you stop getting a value of the CC that's larger after the 1,000. So, I mean, it's really, I think in both cases, it's, it both gets rid of the tendency of Boltzmann brain and things like that, and it improves the actual sort of detail.
All right. So, yes.
So could you have a joint probability of F axion and theta?
Well, yeah, so there you need a more complicated model where you have a distribution of possible F axions. But
so what, well, you've chosen F axion to be 10 to the 16, right?
Right.
Suppose I say, no, it's 10 to the 14. Then,
okay.
Then is that fine, too? Is there any prediction on that, any restriction on F?
Well, I think there would be. I mean, if you would give me some probability distribution over F axion, say you think there's a bunch of vacua with different
initial probability distribution or
yeah.
Anthropically selected probability.
Well, I can do the anthropic selection part. You just have to give me the initial one. Okay. So if you have say you can tunnel into you know 1,000 different vacua from this place. They're all the same except they have different F axions. I don't know if that's a very realistic situation, but say that's the case, and so effectively there's a flat distribution on F axion between 10 to the 12 and the Planck scale.
Flat meaning flat in log of F axion? Or
just in F axion.
Oh.
Okay, then you could compute a joint probability distribution. Then you would probably predict that F axion should be somewhat lower. You know, you could certainly compute that. But actually, look. Why don't I conclude here, and then let's continue with this conversation. So of course that was actually so. All right. So what is there left to do in the future? I think there's a lot of interesting questions here. First of all, the first thing to do is to allow more parameters to vary. You were mentioning F axion. That's certainly an interesting one to allow to vary. I'm not sure we have a very good guess for what the distribution is for F axion in the string landscape, but some other obvious ones are also lambda, delta rho over rho, perhaps the curvature. Okay, this could be generalized, and as Raphael and his student Stefan have been doing this to some extent, but it would be interesting to include the dark matter ratio there. The other very interesting question is observational signatures. So, first of all, Matt is going to finish the paper, which Scott Thomas never finished, and explain how to find them directly using resonant circuits. All right. I will expect to see your paper within the next year. There's also indirect cosmological signatures, such as isocurvature perturbations, and there's certainly some interesting possibilities there. In particular, an isocurvature dipole is something which you would naturally end up with in these models, and that may have been observed. It may be observable. So let me just mention, you could get an isocurvature dipole here without generating a lot of power at the quadrupole.
which would basically mean that the rest frame of the matter is different from the rest frame of the CMB. And I don't know, I've heard vague rumors that there's... I mean, rumors mean probably that someone published a paper that I was not aware of. But anyway, I think there might be some evidence that, that there is such an isocurvature dipole. And then another very important question is, what happens when you embed this in a supersymmetric theory? As soon as you have a supersymmetric theory, you have a superpartner for the axion. This axion can potentially cause all kinds of problems with dark matter. And it would be very important to redo this analysis in that situation. Okay, there's important questions about what happens with the superpartner. What? Yeah. Well, I don't know how hard it is to avoid these axion problems. I mean, people have techniques for doing this, okay. And all right. And you know, also let me remind you that this sort of factor is robust and not dependent on just the axion. So you could analyze this for other dark matter candidates. You know, maybe the dark matter is a WIMP and it's set by the weak scale, but you have a landscape where the weak scale varies. You could do the same analysis there.
In fact, can I just add just a thought about that? Is that, I'll say it before. Sorry. You're concluding. Sorry.
Well, that's probably enough then. Okay. Thank you very much.
Well, I was just saying that actually it seems, just a thought, that it's there are certainly cases where, like for example, Polonyi fields, where you sort of have unwanted contributions to the matter density, which are generically too large. So one comment or question is, maybe this applies just immediately to that case. That's actually one of the, so maybe it means that,
yeah.
The Polonyi problem, which really is a very serious problem if you take Suzy cosmology seriously, has a very
We have to talk about what the prior distribution is. So the prior distribution for the axion was flat in the square root of the dark matter.
I mean, the whole problem is based on, if you believe that there's some amazing thing that makes it zero, you don't have the problem. The whole problem is when you assume that there's a very similar, a very flat potential, and you have a prior, which is of order some scale that's set by the scale over which the potential varies. But then when you make that assumption, you have the problem, but if you make that assumption, you may also have this solution.
Right.
So that's...
Yeah, but so it won't just solve any problem. I mean, it's not magic. It won't solve any problem. I mean, it's a quantitative question of, you have this rather mild dilution factor, and how does your prior interact with that?
I think that's true, because there the problem is more severe, is that you never get out of matter domination, so you may not.
Yeah, well, we should talk about what the...
Okay.
What the...
Yeah.
What I meant earlier, I mean, this puts the axion on a completely different level of plausibility, right, for
the high-scale axion.
Yeah.
I think so, yeah.
And so maybe you don't have to worry that much about embedding it.
Why do you say it makes it more plausible? There's a value for which you don't need this, and it just gets the thing right with generic initial conditions. So why is this more plausible than that?
I didn't hear you.
I don't know why this makes it more plausible. It makes this range of F axion plausible, which is great.
But
for other values of F axion, you get it right without any anthropic mysticism. So,
right. But I mean, if you're happy with those values, then
are they just non-particular
values? Yeah, non-particular values. That's right.
That's the old way.
Well,
the old school thing is that fundamental parameters predict things. So only one fundamental parameter will give you.
That's
very old-fashioned, I know, but...
No, I mean, so really, I would say, I mean, I'm a believer in the landscape and so on, but you could just ask, okay, is it easier to get F axion to be 10 to the 12th, or is it easier to do this anthropic tuning here, okay? I think it's an interesting open question. If it's not hard to build theories with F axion of 10 to the 12th, then just do it, yeah.
Any other questions or comments? Okay, so we'll let's thank you. First of all, let's. Oh, sorry.
Just one last
are volume weighted basically, but do this time resetting. No?
Well, I haven't been able to understand what the precise prescription is for that.
Well, they had this very recent. Most recent work.
Yeah, I tried to read it and I was not able to understand a consistent prescription for computing quantities, so I didn't do that calculation. But I would be happy to be, if you can explain to me what they're doing, I would be very happy to know what it is. These are the only two measures that I know how to compute things in.
All around, any more questions? Okay, well, let's thank Dan again. We'll meet back here at 2 o'clock to find a lunch place. Attach yourself to a local person. Local people, raise their hand.